Welcome to our 9th episode of Share the Air. This is our second to last episode before the final episode of the season. So definitely be sure to check out all of our previous episodes from the second season. And just, you know, a friendly reminder that if you're craving more Share the Air content, you can subscribe to our Patreon. We'll continue to put out bonus episodes, teas with Tina, all sorts of other bonus content while we're on our in-between season break.
That's all on our Patreon at patreon.com/sharetheair.
We struggled a little bit to come up with an intro topic for this week's episode. A lot of things that we can't talk about for whatever reason, but I thought I could give an update on the plant that Tulsa gave me because we had talked about this in an intro for a previous episode.
Did it survive the freeze
it
in my
did.
Trunk?
A couple of leaves.
Yeah.
A couple of leaves passed. And they were like brown and wet and stuff. It was like, yeah. And I'm assuming it's because they froze and then thawed. But the spider plant is doing great. Oh, it's good. Sitting on, there's like a decorative fireplace that we have. And so it's sitting on the mantle and it's flourishing. My uncle has many plants and like takes excellent care of them. They're really beautiful. And he was telling me about how if a certain branch or something is like really already dead, that you need to snip it so that water and nutrients get focused on the other branches and leaves that are producing fruit and stuff. And so I was like, okay, so I found all the like the edges of those leaves that were already dead and I snipped those, but I couldn't, there was one of them that was really close to the edge. So I was nervous to pull it or anything. So there's one leaf that is growing big and strong, but the very tip of it is all brown and weird looking, but the rest of the plant is doing great.
Oh,
it looks great. Yeah. So thank you for that. I love it.
With all of that and our babbling about our plant hobby, thank you for listening and enjoy our episode with Rena. This episode has an explicit content rating because it includes a few swears, and also just a heads up that we talk about injuries, including ACL injuries, and we also discuss relationships with food and nutrition.
Today, Share the Air is joined by physical therapist Rena Eliazar. Rena has her doctorate in physical therapy from New York University and is also a board-certified clinical specialist in sports physical therapy and certified strength and conditioning specialist. In 2014, she co-founded MatchFit Performance, a sports performance practice focusing on the athlete as a whole, from injury all the way to performance. MatchFit has worked with athletes on teams such as the Brooklyn and Long Island Nets and the Gotham Knights Rugby Football Club, and currently services athletes on Ultimate Frisbee teams like New York Empire, New York Gridlock, and a number of club teams. Rena currently competes in Olympic weightlifting and is an ambassador for Lululemon. We're excited to have Rena here with us today.
So, Rena, I think the place we'd like to start is if you can share with us your background in sports.
I was a competitive swimmer growing up. I swam for about 15 years until my freshman year of college. And after that, I was involved in dance. In college, I was on a hip-hop dance team. So that was how I kind of stayed active. I didn't really find serious strength and conditioning until I was in graduate school. So in 2011, I started PT school at NYU. In 2012, I was studying for the Certified Strength and Conditioning Specialist exam, and some of the movements that we had needed to be familiar with were some of the Olympic weightlifting movements. At the time, CrossFit was on the rise. It was kind of booming, and one of my classmates, who was my desk buddy all throughout PT school, she had signed up for a CrossFit class, and just like a typical CrossFitter, could not stop talking about it. And she said that it was really exciting, super fun. It was competitive, although you were really just competing with yourself. And as a swimmer, that's a big thing about swimming too. You're really competing with yourself for a lot of things. And so I gave it a shot and really enjoyed it. I loved lifting heavy stuff and being able to say that I could lift this much, or it was more than my body weight, twice my body weight, whatever. And so I did that for a long time until probably about 2016, 2017, which was when I started working a lot. I had founded MatchFit with my partner, Erwin Segia, And it just took up a lot of time. And it was also just really hard on my body. And I couldn't do the right things that I needed to do in order to be able to recover well from training that hard. So around 2017, I want to say, is when I switched to exclusively weightlifting and started competing in 2018. And now that is pretty much what I do. There's a little bit of other stuff sprinkled in there, like running. I'll occasionally drop into a CrossFit class if I'm traveling or something. But for the most part, one of my big goals for this year is to make nationals for weightlifting. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. That's exciting. I think that piece is really interesting about the similarities between swimming and CrossFit. And I imagine Olympic weightlifting too, of like competing against yourself. I hadn't really thought about how those are similar in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting because I work with a lot of team sports. And sure, when I was younger, I dabbled in soccer, basketball. I can't remember what else, but I was definitely one of the more active kids in my family. So I did a lot of different things and just whatever it was about an individual sport. I also did gymnastics when I was little too. So whatever it was about individual sports was really what has kept me going in a lot of ways.
So you started competitive sports after you were kind of being asked to be familiar with the strength and conditioning exam. So you weren't really doing like any of those movements sort of beforehand. You decided that you wanted to be studying that and get that specialist training prior to actually like working with that and everything.
Yeah, so we actually, it was a requirement for our program to pass that exam in order to graduate. So I'll be honest, at first, I didn't really see the value in it. I thought I was pretty knowledgeable enough to be able to make a program for somebody. But kind of looking back and seeing how I've built on that foundational knowledge, it was actually what set me up to do what I'm doing now. And when I was swimming, there wasn't really a strength and conditioning program. Even when I was in college, going through high school, I swam at a YMCA. I swam for a private club team. And it was kind of like, okay, go in the gym, do one round on the machines, do about like three sets of 10 to 15 on each machine. And all right, that's it. Now we're going to jump in the pool. And then when I got to college, it was kind of interesting. I mean, I walked on the team. So a lot of the people had already been there. They were recruited, so they had been training together for a while. And I like sort of knew what I was doing, but didn't really know how to ask for help and didn't know how to ask what I should be doing because I had no idea. So I just kind of followed one of my teammates around. She went down to run on the treadmills, so I went to run on the treadmills. And then she came back upstairs and did some like bench pressing stuff. And I was like, okay, I know how to bench. Like, this is cool. But yeah, it wasn't until after I was in PT school and had taken this exam and joined CrossFit that I was actually interested in a lot of barbell work. And then after my, I say competitive CrossFit days, but it was like not even that. I was very fascinated early on with the weightlifting movements because they are so technical. There's so much physics involved. And that just, I'm a nerd, so that fascinates me.
Maybe to jump to the founding of MatchFit, was philosophies like that and really having an eye for the movements and the science part of the founding of MatchFit?
Absolutely. It's pretty, I'd say still pretty rampant in the fitness industry today, especially, and rehab for sure. But there used to be such a separation between rehab and fitness / performance, and rehab, whenever people think of rehab, they think of really easy banded exercises. You never touch any kind of weight. And then when you think of general fitness, for some people, that is still banded exercises and very light weight. You know, maybe the most weight they do is on a spin bike and they pull some 3-pounders and do some arm exercises. And then you get to performance. When people think of performance, it's deadlifting, squatting, clean, snatches, heavy stuff, and it kind of freaks people out. And so when we founded MatchFit, we were trying to be the bridge between all of those, because all of that exists on a spectrum. When you're in rehab, it's modified strength and conditioning. You're finding, in any case, you're finding a person's baseline, you're meeting them where they are, and you're designing something to help them progress to whatever their goal is. So in rehab, if you have somebody who's been, I don't know, back squatting over 200 pounds for years, and they come in and you're just giving them banded exercises or unweighted exercises, like, that's not going to help them. They need to understand how to control their bodies in the realm that they want to be in, which is maybe powerlifting. Maybe it's training for their sport. But we wanted to make it very simple for people. And then again, try to build that bridge between all of those stages, because they all intersect.
How did MatchFit begin working with Ultimate Frisbee? Because you were definitely working with other teams and other sports and athletes in different sports. So how did you stumble into Ultimate Frisbee?
So my partner, Erwin, also has his board certification in sports. He got it, I believe, a year before me. And so in order to sit for this exam, you needed hours covering some kind of sport. It could be practices, it could be training sessions, it could be being in the gym with people, it could be offering your services at a road race or something. And so when Erwin was looking for places to do his hours, he shot out a post on Facebook and got connected some circuitous way to Izzy Bryant. And so Izzy was playing for Empire. They were able to get connected. And so the first thing that we did for Ultimate was sitting sideline at practices for Empire. Through that, we got contacted to cover some regional events, some sectional events through Disc NY. When gridlock became an idea, Eileen was kind enough to reach out to us and bring us on for gridlock. And I guess the rest is history. We've been in the community now since, I think, 2016, maybe. So it's been a while, and a wild ride.
So what now, having worked, what is it now, about 5 years with Ultimate Frisbee players in different gender divisions and different leagues, how does it compare to be training Ultimate Frisbee athletes to athletes of another sport?
Honestly, it's kind of refreshing, because in some other sports, you have a lot of people who, there's a lot of ego involved when it comes to their strength and conditioning. And there are people who think that they know more than they actually know when it comes to strength and conditioning. So I've definitely had some experiences in other sports where, I don't know if it was, maybe it was because I'm a woman, I don't know, but there are definitely some times where people are either not comfortable asking me questions or don't want to ask me about certain things because they're unsure that I know the answer based on who I am. Whereas coming into Ultimate, for a lot of people, it was their first sport, and it was a sport that they just played, and they played it because it was fun. Once they got more competitive, there are a lot of programs and avenues out there where you can potentially have a really well-rounded strength and conditioning program. But I think what we do differently with MatchFit is that we actually take the person who's in front of us. Like, sure, we can write a generalized program, but I think the benefit of what we do is that from that generalized program, we can also specify it to the person and the kind of player that you are, the kind of goals you've set for yourself as a player. And that's just not something you get with some of these templated programs. And that's probably my favorite part of my job, is being able to educate someone and then also showing them what their body's capable of. Because like I said, a lot of times that rehab to fitness to performance spectrum is just so spread out, and people just don't realize what their body can do. So I love that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think that one of the coolest things since I started working with MatchFit was that I did when I first got started, the most accessible things were some of those templated programs. And yeah, I remember at one point, maybe like a couple months into working with Erwin and MatchFit, like being told that I didn't have to look exactly like the picture or the video in terms of specifically form. And that was really eye-opening for me for, you know, I think I started lifting maybe more around like my senior year of college. And a lot of the programs are like, everything's like a 90 degree angle and how like strict some things feel. And I always felt like I was doing things wrong or was like, maybe told in conversation that I was doing something wrong because I didn't look exactly how someone else looked, whether it was a picture or whether it was the person that I was lifting with. So that's been a really cool thing is something that I've learned is everybody's body is unique and you don't have to look exactly like something else in order to be doing it right or in order to be making progress. So,
yeah. I think that's one of our biggest things that we harp on to people, especially when they're newer to resistance training is this exactly that. Like, you don't have to look exactly like the video or look exactly like the picture. If you have extra range of motion because you're very mobile, that's okay. You should actually train the range of motion that you have. You shouldn't stop yourself just because somebody says that your knees shouldn't go over your toes or that it's dangerous to squat ass to grass. It's actually not. But yeah, I love that light bulb that goes off when people realize, oh, my body is actually capable of a lot of things, and this is one of them, and it's awesome.
Is that something, that sort of like notion that I have to look a certain way or I have to do something in an exact way, is that a common thing that you've experienced working with Frisbee players who are maybe new to lifting, or are there other, you know, misconceptions that you've had to get your Frisbee athletes to begin on learning?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest one is squatting. Like, for years, not just in sports, but in fitness in general, there was this rule that your feet had to be parallel, they had to be hip width apart, your knees shouldn't pass over your toes, you shouldn't squat all the way down because it's going to put too much compression on your knees. And you just look at different people's bodies and you realize that, one, in a lot of ways, like not letting your knees pass over your toes in a squat is literally impossible because then you're going to fall over. And so trying to explain that to different people, because when they come in to see us and I just ask them to squat and it's almost like they look stuck at parallel and they're trying really hard to stop themselves from going anywhere lower. And I kind of give them a look and I say, are you able to go lower than that? They go, well, yeah, but someone I worked with or somebody told me that I'm not supposed to go past parallel. I said, well, does it hurt when you go past parallel? And they say, no. I'm like, okay, let's go past parallel then. And so things like that. Probably the other one is that deadlifting has to look a certain way. And on Instagram, I put out a poll relatively recently that asked what makes people scared of lifting heavy. And a lot of questions that came up were comments that came up was about form and technique. And my take on that is in order to get stronger and challenge your form, you actually have to start. Like, you have to start with the first rep, because if you don't, then you're never going to be able to challenge that form. You're not going to know if you're getting stronger to be able to maintain that form. And then also when it comes to form, as things get heavier and you're maxing out your capacity, like, yeah, your form's going to break down a little bit. But as long as it's not so far over your current capacity, like, that's when injuries happen, is that when people make a really, really big jump, or they're just lifting way too much after taking a break or something. And for something like deadlifts, like, that's usually when those injuries happen. And so it's usually not form related. It's usually capacity related. And then we talk about load a lot and how do we measure load and what does that look like for each person? So trying to get people to understand that as well, because that notion of I need to have perfect form in order to lift heavy, it's such a limiter, and it holds a lot of people back and it holds a lot of people from getting started.
I've learned a lot from you and especially your Instagram, because I think you do a lot of this like uncovering and questioning narratives that exist in fitness and sports world. And I feel like it's really valuable. I think one of the other ones that I learned from working with you all is like not all pain is bad and means you should stop. And that was kind of mind blowing for me to be like, yeah, okay, I guess not.
Yeah. So when you're sore, you warm up, things feel good, things kind of loosen up, you feel able to participate. Great. But what happens when you have some kind of nagging pain? You warm up and it doesn't go away or it gets worse. So that we try to educate a lot on those differences between what can you play through and what shouldn't you play through.
Yeah, just a quick aside, but I think that was a really crazy thing about working with Matchfit for the first time, and maybe just the novelty of being on a semi-professional team, was that when I had my concussion, Matchfit communicated that with my coaches and like worked through a plan with the coaches of how I would return to play, how I would address the injury and recovery while also trying to get me back into playing, and that both could happen sort of at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you bring up a great point about concussion, because the previous advice about concussion is, oh, you have a concussion, go sit in a dark room, close your eyes, don't do anything, don't think too hard, don't listen to music, don't watch TV, don't look at your phone, just stop. Whereas what we're learning and honestly, the brain is so complex that the model of how concussions happen and how they heal is constantly changing. But as far as the going theory now, as your brain is recovering, it requires a whole lot of energy. It's the power grid of your body. So it requires a lot of energy, which explains a lot of fatigue that people feel. When you start to stress it, kind of like if you sprained an ankle, for example, and you start to do stuff on that ankle, it's probably going to be a little bit sore. Your brain can't really get sore, so it gives you all these other things, the dizziness, the brain fog, the tiredness. So being able to understand and accept that that might happen if you push yourself a little bit too far, but also trusting your body that it will heal and it will get you back is that delicate balance where it always helps to have really good communication with either your provider and training staff and your coaches. And that's what we try to do for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's another piece that related that has been really helpful for me in having you all working with Gridlock is that I think a lot of athletes may feel a similar thing. You're always wanting to like get back to playing as soon as possible. And it's really helpful to have somebody there who's knowledgeable and can be like, not yet, hold up, and can communicate that to the coaches. Because oftentimes it's like, we need people playing at practice. Can you play? And you're like, I could play. And if you're like, nope, not today, then that's so much more helpful than having to be the one that decides that.
Yeah, for sure. And in a lot of cases, it's not that if you're injured, you can't play at all, right? There are definitely some instances where, okay, maybe you'd be part of this drill, but you're not marking or you're not being marked very hard so that you can still get some reps in that are lower intensity. Everybody understands that when you are on the field, that's where you are. And then being able to progress that so that, one, you're still very involved in the game, right? Because the biggest thing with any field sport, really, it's like, sure, the training and the strength and conditioning, like that's one part of it. But the other part of it is that field sense. So if we hold you out of all of these things that tax your brain in different ways, but are still skills that are needed in order to play the game, we do you a disservice with that. So we always try to find a way to keep an athlete involved in either in practice or playtime, whatever, as much as possible so that you still have that kind of stimulation, even if you can't fully participate in it physically.
And now, Share the Air will take a break to talk about today's teachable moment, brought to you by our sponsor, the Center for Applied Neuroscience. We asked our audience what neuroscience you wanted explained, and we have Dr. Wintink here to answer your questions.
Today's question is, what kind of team environment is best for growth and development, and what kind of team environment is the worst for growth and development?
One of the most important elements of a good team environment is the ratio of positive reinforcement to punishment. From the brain's perspective, positive reinforcement is a necessary component for building on strengths, doing well, and enhancing performance. So positive reinforcement is increasing the likelihood that those good things will keep happening. So telling people, I like what you're doing great, giving them that feedback. And that is reinforcing because it activates the dopamine system. And so the dopamine system of the brain is that reward, the I want more, like I want to do more of what I was doing that got me that positive feedback. So it's this really nice cycle where the brain is just kind of thriving on doing more of those things. It's freely flowing. So the punishment system is the stopping behaviors. We stop behaviors by critiquing them. I mean, really just critiquing them and saying like, that's wrong or that's bad. That is punishment. It's necessary. So it's really about the balance. So if we're constantly punishing the brain and not rewarding the brain, then that's going to be a maladaptive environment. It's just not a place where people can thrive. So we need to have more of the positive reinforcement versus the punishment style. So that's one element from like the individual level. And I think the team dynamics, the bonding that happens is really important for growth and really development. So as humans, we are social creatures. Our brain thrives on like the social connections and the hormones that are related to that. So oxytocin is a hormone that we know facilitates bonding at like an infant level. So when a baby is born and they're connecting with their caregiver, then, you know, there's oxytocin that is being released in the newborn and also in the caregiver. So that's something that we're born with. It's innate, but that continues throughout life. Oxytocin is released during orgasm as we have companions and when we hug people. So there's all these known mechanisms to create bonding in humans. And that feels good. That facilitates memory. And it, again, facilitates the dopamine of wanting to stay connected and keep doing things. And so that's also another important aspect of growth and development on a team is that having people feel connected to each other and also to the goal. That shared goal that a team might have brings people together. So I think those are two really important ones.
Thanks to our sponsor, Dr. Mandy Wintink and the Center for Applied Neuroscience for this teachable moment. Head to www.knowyourbrain.ca and see what courses they have to teach you more about your brain. If you mention that you heard about them here, you'll get a 5% discount off course fees, and they'll also donate 5% back to Share the Air. Since we're kind of already, we've already kind of gotten into it and maybe debunked a couple already, but talking about some of those misconceptions in sports and in training. Rena, we have like a list of some of those misconceptions. Yeah. So we could prompt you for one. We could just like, you can just like rapid fire whatever misconception you want to talk about.
Let me see. Ooh, the speed. I like the speed and agility letters.
Wait, yes, no, let's debunk speed and agility ladders. I feel like I've been on so many teams that love to use them. And as someone who has no rhythm at all, and it's so embarrassing every time I'm on a team and a new footwork thing is introduced with a ladder, it's terrible. Like, I'm like, great, okay, I'll go spend the next week like learning how to do this so that the next practice I won't embarrass myself. Like I can do like in and out steps. Like I can do some of the, I think the basic ones at this point, but oh my God, introduce anything more complicated and I'm done. It's not happening. I'll end up tripping and I drag the rest of the ladder with me, like in between my feet.
Yeah. The thing about ladders, it's like, when you are on a field, when are you going to be doing these little steppy patterns through really tiny space things? It is a good way to start loading after some kind of lower body injury, so like an ankle injury, a knee injury, starting to work on some low intensity directional changes. But doing all of those super super fast, some people wear resistance bands with it. It's so unnecessary to me. And a better use of your time would be teaching people how to redirect their speed and redirect their force quickly instead of doing all these little, basically looking like a dance move between your an agility ladder. So those components, like if we were to break down a cut, right? You run into a cut, there's a lot of deceleration where you basically come to a stop and then you explode out of it. And depending on the direction of that cut, you have to redirect a lot of momentum and a lot of force. And so what is the base of that? The base of that is being really strong and being able to handle that deceleration. And that's where, with a lot of non-contact injuries, where you see people tear their ACLs, their MCL, damage their meniscus, that's kind of a lot of that problem, is that their muscles are not decelerating their bodies. And then they end up in a position that usually the knee joint is not prepared for. And so a lot of people come to us, they say, I really want to improve my first step. Okay, how do you do that? You have to be strong, and then you have to be able to produce that force quickly to get you off your spot. So yeah, that's my hot take on that. Agility ladders do not make you faster or more agile.
So I could now tell my team we should just cut that out of our warm-up, because I never like it anyway.
I feel so tired. I'm like, now you want me to play a whole game after I've just done this? I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Okay, what other misconceptions do you have that you want to debunk?
I mean, my bread and butter is talking about fear of getting bulky, I would say.
Let's do it.
So we can talk about that.
And this is specifically, or usually with women.
Yeah, usually aimed towards women. And it's usually when you think of heavy lifting. And my whole thing about that is, first of all, one, what's bulky? Is bulky gaining muscle? Because usually a lot of people, their goal is to look quote unquote toned. And in order to look toned, you actually have to gain some muscle. So to me, my first question is, what is bulky? What does that mean? And then the second part of that, when people say, well, I don't want to put on weight like The Rock. I don't want to look like The Rock, or I don't want to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And my counter to that is, first of all, they have to eat so much. You have to constantly be shoving food in your face in order to be able to get that big. And then two, you have to be putting in hours and hours and hours in the gym every day. There is so much detail and attention and prep that goes into looking like that, that you simply, unless that's your goal, like you just, it just simply won't happen.
So you all started working with, Frisbee players through things like New York Empire and New York Gridlock, which have single game formats, right? You play one game for what it was like 90 minutes or whatever, 50, an hour-ish.
Yeah.
One night a week, you're playing that game. For Empire, they have, you know, their season is one game a week, but in the PUL, there's like a couple weeks in between each game. How was it when you started working with some of these athletes more as they moved into their club season? Were you at all surprised to find that people were, you know, going from playing one game a night to then playing eight games in a 2-day span once a month?
I wouldn't say we were surprised. Mm-hmm. We were definitely prepared for it. Well, I shouldn't even say we were prepared for it. We expected it. We'll put it that way. We expected it. And the biggest challenge there, because obviously we can't tell you to not play in one thing versus the other, because it just wouldn't work. So what we try to do at the very beginning is, again, like leading into that pro season where we have preseason, and hopefully athletes have been working in the off season, like that period of time is the most important, because that's where you're laying your foundation that's going to carry you through both the pro and the club season. So when we get to a point where, I guess it's like mid pro season where the club season starts, we know that volume is going to spike. So physically, we're generally prepared for what our athletes will be dealing with. The biggest thing we can harp on with them is to make sure you're recovering. And that's where a lot of the nutrition stuff comes in, is because with the club tournaments also comes club practices, and sometimes those are back-to-back on weekends for 3 to 4 hours a day. So we want to make sure that going into it, you're at least prepared in that way to understand what your body needs and how to be able to recover so that when you come back from that tournament and maybe you come into pro practice again, or maybe you have another club practice that following week, the biggest thing at those points in the season is just making sure that you're able to recover from all of that activity. Mm-hmm. Definitely what I try to do leading into a tournament or into a long practice weekend is just making sure that people are eating a good amount going into it, and then helping them understand how they can best fuel themselves afterwards so that you can feel relatively recovered for the following day if it's back to back or a 2-day tournament, and then how to continue doing that to be ready for the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You always also ask us about our sleep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sleeping. And it's one of those things where some people are just not good at sleeping. And so that's something that we try to address as best as we can, obviously within our scope of practice. If there's something that we see that might need a referral elsewhere, we try to get that for our athletes. But sleep is like when all the magic happens. So so people who say they can survive on 5 hours of sleep a night but are pounding 3 coffees a day, like those are the kind of people we watch out for and try to give some try to switch some habits around there.
Yeah, working with MatchFit was the first time that I think I was told how important sleep is. Like, yes, we know sleep is important, right? We all have to do it. But to hear that it's actually really important in order to recover and prepare for tournaments, MatchFit was sort of the first thing that I had worked with that said that and stressed that. So now I try to sleep before tournaments.
Just before tournaments.
Yeah, though. Just before tournaments.
Never. No other time.
I wondered about some of the diet culture narratives that exist of like carbs are bad for you, fats are bad for you, labeling foods as good and bad. I don't know if you want to take on any of those.
Yeah, I can definitely touch on that. Unfortunately, diet culture has been so pervasive in the fitness industry, in the sports industry, in marketing in general, and especially towards women, that I'm not surprised that a lot of my athletes, when I'm assessing where they are and taking a look at how they're fueling and everything, that yes, most of them are under eating. And as far as demonizing any type of food or any type of food group, it's ridiculous. I think there is a place for all different types of food in a person's diet. Food is very social. Food is cultural. Food is not something that needs to be demonized at any point. And so when an athlete in particular tells me that they do not eat carbs, or they strictly avoid refined sugar, or
they don't eat white carbs.
They don't eat white carbs. And so whenever I ask them why, a lot of it is because they've been told it's bad for you. And when you think of how your body's physiology works, your body's preferred form of energy is carbohydrates. It's glucose. Your body uses that glucose to create ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell. And if you have free-floating glucose in your blood, that process happens very easily. If you do not have free-floating glucose in your blood, your body has to work really hard to deconstruct a whole bunch of other stuff in order to organically create glucose in order to make that ATP. And that process just takes a lot longer to happen. And so particularly with athletes, when they're feeling super fatigued, when they're totally gassed at practice, when you notice a big performance drop in the second half of a game, one of the biggest things I talk about is making sure that you have carbs on the sideline, and they can, and God forbid I tell somebody to have jelly beans or like fruit snacks or gummy bears on the sideline. It's like their eyes explode. And so your body likes those simple carbs that can be digested really easily. in order to give you that energy. And especially in a sport like Ultimate Frisbee, you need a nice aerobic base because games are pretty long. Sometimes points can get pretty long, but you're also sprinting and cutting a lot. And that requires a lot of energy from your muscles. And in order to continue supplying your muscles with that energy, you need to have some of that glucose floating around. So in the absence of a actual medical condition or a chronic condition where you actually need to avoid carbs, I tell people that they can eat whatever kind of carb they want. Anything, you know, rice. I eat rice and or pasta almost every single day. And so, like, Filipino culture, our food, you always have it with rice. And so that's part of the cultural part of it. But also, it's okay to have rice. It's okay to have bread. And then labeling food as good or bad, like, you can eat a bag of potato chips once in a while. It's okay.
Share the Air will be right back. But first, here's a quick word from our sponsors.
Share the Air is sponsored by the National Ultimate Training Camp, located in Western Massachusetts. NUTSI is the longest-running ultimate sleepover camp in the country. It has also gone international, hosting camps and teaching clinics all over the globe. With the most talented coaches in the world, NUTSI is teaching ultimate for the next generation. Learn from the best at NUTSI.
Share the Air is also sponsored by BC Ultimate. BC has been producing custom uniforms and performance apparel since 1998. A company that proudly puts values and community before profit, BC is the world's best source for quality design and all your ultimate needs. You can support BC and rep Share the Air jerseys by checking out our team store at bcultimate.com.
I have a question, and you can tell me if this is wrong, but I feel like I, for a long time, especially when I was in high school, the kind of workouts that we did were run your body into the ground sprint workouts. And I feel like I've heard that being challenged recently, that to get faster, your workout might not always leave you feeling dead tired.
Yes.
Oh, good.
So in order for a sprint workout to be a true sprint workout, you actually have to be sprinting and working at almost maximal speed. And so if you're just running wind sprints until you're dead, like, there's a point where that doesn't become a sprint anymore. That doesn't become your repeatable mm-hmm. speed anymore. And so when people think of sprint conditioning, exactly what you said, they're like, oh, I should be dead. I should be really tired afterwards. No, not exactly, because you need to be able to repeat that sprint multiple times with decreasing amounts of rest. And so, yes, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be dead. What you kind of want to watch out for when you're doing those repeated sprints is, am I giving myself enough time to recover in between so that I can hit the same speed every time? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sometimes you sprint 10 yards or 10 meters and you have a minute rest in between. And of course, people don't know what to do with themselves for a minute. They just like, should I be doing planks? Should I be doing something? Like, no, breathe, rest your legs, get ready for the next rep, because you need, the goal is to be able to repeat that and do it the same every single time. So yeah, sometimes I feel like, at least at the beginning, when I'm working with someone new who has come from that mentality of speed work means that I'm going to be dead at the end of this session. And I say, you're going to do 10 meter runs with a minute rest in between. They're like, is this right? Yeah. Is this what you really want me to do? I'm like, yes. And I want you to take the rest because I want you to be able to repeat that same effort at that same level every single time.
So the idea is that over time, doing that training consistently, you would be able to recover faster and still hit your max speed, but with less rest time.
So not necessarily. So the way, at least the way that we've learned for training speed is that you want to hit slightly above the max speed that you hit in a game.
Okay.
With these specific sprint workouts. Because if you can hit a higher ceiling and then during a game, your effort is actually a little bit below that ceiling, then you have a huge reserve. You know, when you need that last kick or something, you have a pretty big reserve there. So to be able to do those repeated sprints, basically the way I would approach it is if I know on average how long your cuts are, for example, then I will try to program something where you are trying to hit top speed for potential, maybe it's slightly longer in time, maybe it's slightly longer in distance, but I want you to be able to sustain that for a slightly longer period of time so that when you're in the game and you actually make that cut, you're going to be able to do it over and over again.
Gotcha.
And so when we talk about building capacity and building muscle and tendon and ligament resilience, that's kind of what we're talking about. Like we want to, in the off season and preseason, we want to push you to the attic of the house so that if your effort during a game reaches, we'll say, the second floor, then you still have a reserve. You're still able to recover from that. And so this becomes a lot easier when you have all the cute techie things that can give you all of this data, but we kind of work with what we got. So
Sweet.
Yeah.
So Rena, sometimes we ask some repeat questions, and one question that we ask is if there's any message that you want to share with the Ultimate community or whoever is listening to this podcast.
A message I would like to share is to not be afraid of picking up some weights.
Yeah.
And just get started. Starting's always the hardest part, and the rest of it comes later.
Awesome.
Cool. What's next for you, Rena? Or perhaps what's next for MatchFit?
I'll say what's next for me because I'm not sure I can share what's next for MatchFit yet.
Okay.
So for me, I am, well, we're both excited to be coming back on with Gridlock this season. So I'm excited to work with you all for the next few months. And for me, sports-wise, I think I mentioned earlier, I'm trying to qualify for USA Weightlifting Nationals at the end of this year. So I've been training a lot for that, and really trying to heed my own advice and make sure I'm recovering and eating and doing all the right things. But yeah, it's been a trek. You go into these things and you know it's going to be hard, but sometimes it's just really hard. So, but thankfully I have good support, so I'm excited. And these next few months working with Gridlock, and then the months following that, we'll be ramping up again to hopefully compete in November, December, I think. So
cool.
We'll see.
That's exciting.
I have a national level meet that's not quite as high as USA Weightlifting Nationals, but it's at the Arnold Sports Festival in Columbus, Ohio. I'm competing in a couple weeks. So,
yeah. Cool. That's awesome.
Good luck.
Thanks. I'll share the streams if y'all want to watch.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. You watch our streams. Yeah. Okay. Should we play a game?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Rena, we're going to play 10 Second Stall, which is our game from the first season. And basically, we'll ask you a question from the time we start asking the question to when you give your answer. You have 10 seconds.
Okay.
If you hit 10 seconds and you haven't answered, we'll say stall you out.
Oh, God. Okay.
And Lou and I will just take turns asking questions.
Yeah. All right. Hang on. I gotta
get
ready.
Tulsa, did you look at the questions? Was there any one that you, is there anything you want to add or anything like that?
We have 8 questions.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
That seems pretty
That's
good.
That's a lot. Okay. Cool. I'm ready.
Yeah, here we go.
What is your favorite time of the day to train?
Late morning.
What's your most used emoji?
The laughing face with the eyes going, the two arrows pointing inwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your favorite exercise to do in the gym?
A snatch.
If you had a walkout or goal celebration song, what would it be?
Walkout song is definitely Power by Kanye West.
What is your favorite meal to eat after a really hard workout?
Probably some kind of pasta. I like just a gigantic bowl of pasta and just like throw in a whole bunch of stuff on it.
Weirdest thing that Ultimate players do?
Huh. I can't think of one.
I realized we should have talked about rolling. I feel like you and Erwin have some opinions on foam rolling.
Oh, we do.
Wait. Okay, wait, let's finish the questions and then actually let's ask about foam rolling. Because okay. That's something that I feel like so many players do. I feel like, yeah, my time
okay,
on bent.
Save it.
Yeah, okay. Is it my question?
No, I think it's me. Okay. Who is someone you're grateful for?
Oh, hopefully he listens to this episode, but I'm very grateful for Erwin for being just a partner in all things.
What's the most embarrassing fashion trend you've ever worn?
Ooh. I don't even know what to call them. I guess they're like culottes or like the gaucho pants.
The big like flowy yeah. Black. Yeah. Awesome. That's Sensei
Gonzalez. Sensei Gonzalez. You did great. Nice. You didn't get stalled yeah. out.
No, wait. Kind
oh,
of.
That
but
one.
We didn't
I
ever
guess.
Say stall.
I guess. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. You did great.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we want to talk about foam rolling?
Yes. What are the misconceptions about foam rolling?
Oh, so foam rolling, I guess this can kind of apply to massage guns too, but foam rolling does not break down your fascia, and it doesn't rearrange your tissues to make them more pliable or more flexible. It doesn't break down scar tissue. It does not increase your flexibility. In research, it's been said that subjectively, so if you were to ask somebody if they were sore before foam rolling versus asking them if they're sore after foam rolling, subjectively, people will say they feel less sore, but it doesn't actually change whatever physiology and healing and the process that is going on in your muscles when they actually are sore. So the people that say it speeds up recovery, that has not been proven. By going to town on your muscles, you're not loosening anything up. If anything, if you're someone like me who actually really hates foam rolling because it's just painful and uncomfortable and just doesn't really do anything for me, you're just putting yourself in more pain, which actually increases your stress response, which is what you don't want to do when you're trying to recover. the other thing is people say it improves blood flow to the area. You don't have to do that before you warm up, because when you warm up, that's exactly what you're doing. So I think those are all the bullet points on foam rolling.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of placebo. Like if it feels good for you.
Yeah. If it feels good.
Whatever.
Great. And it's like, and it's part of your routine. Sure. But I, the biggest thing about that when people are like, oh, so should I just not foam roll? And biggest thing for me is if it helps you get ready for what you're about to do, fine. But it's not doing any of those things that people usually tell you foam rolling does.
Mm-hmm. Every time I think about going to a tournament and just seeing people on the sidelines rolling out every part of their body, including IT bands, oof, which I learned yeah. recently, don't do that. It's supposed to be tight.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. IT bands are supposed to be tight.
What I'm feeling is that we need to have our Tea with Tina series, except it's Rena's hot takes about
yeah.
all things fitness.
Debunk this. Yeah.
If you have Tea with Tina, I'm trying to think. I can't do alliteration, but I'd be down to be like coffee with Rena.
Cool. Well, thank you, Rena, so much for joining us on this episode of Share the Air. We'll think about what the title of our repeat series after this, maybe Reps with Rena or something like that.
Ooh.
Hey. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah,
it was really
you,
fun to get some answers to these burning questions.
Yeah, I appreciate you all. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. If you like the podcast and want to support us, here are a few things that you can do.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Share the Air Podcast and on Twitter at Share the Air Pod.
You can also rate and review us, and most importantly, subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen.
And if you want to show more support or you just can't get enough of Share the Air, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/sharetheair. If you're interested in repping some Share the Air gear, check out our VC Ultimate store at vcultimate.com.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at team@sharetheairpodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Thanks so much for listening.
Share the Air is recorded and edited by Tulsa Douglas and Louisa Nevis. It is planned and produced by Tulsa Douglas, Louisa Nevis, and Tim Bobrowski.
Share the Air's music is by Gray Devlin and Christopher Hernandez.
Finally, thanks again to our sponsors, NUTC, VC Ultimate, and the Center for Applied Neuroscience.